The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets remain technically challenged. Inflation is heating up again. Reviewing the week and listener questions. All this and much more on episode number 587 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey there, and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast for Sunday, November 11th, 2018. This is Andrew Horowitz, and I am your host of the show, in a kind of a fun mood today. Pretty cool week, great weekend. I saw the movie Bohemian Rhapsody last night. Man, that was awesome. I got to tell you something, that was just an absolutely terrific movie. The acting was superb. When you see these movies that have singing in it and they lip sync, it's kind of off and it's weird. I don't know, somehow it worked for me. And the story of Freddie Mercury and Queen, a band that I was very much into as a kid and love their stuff still, just was, I thought, really a tremendous effort. Now, I'm not sure exactly how true to real life it stuck, but I highly recommend it. Anybody that's a Queen fan or even enjoy the music or a few of the songs, everybody loves the song Bohemian Rhapsody. Come on. I think you should see it. Really great, great movie. So I even think that we could see some Academy Awards and some Oscars for this particular performance. It was that good. At least I thought so. Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of you out there going to be like, oh, it was terrible. It was not really, didn't really hold up to this. I thought it was great. So let me know what you think about that. We have a few things to talk about today. We're going to do some of the listener questions, as I promised, because we're giving away some books. That's right. We're giving away a copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, a book I wrote in the mid-2000s. Seems like so long ago, but it was also seems like yesterday. And it goes over technical analysis and fundamental analysis, quantitative analysis, talks about a variety of ways to find stocks using tools, techniques, understanding what all the terminology is inside of that, just a whole host of things. You can actually get it on Amazon over on audiobooks, probably one of the best ways to get it, and listen to it that way. So if you want to do so, or try if you can to send me in a question, and we'll read it on the air and randomly pick one of the questions that we read throughout the week now through the end of the year to see who's a winner. And we have a winner this week as well. But now here we are. It is the middle part of November. The elections are, well, that's funny. I was thinking about that. Well, the elections are over, but not really, right? I mean, we got recounts again. Where? Hello, Broward County, Florida, right? In the area that I live. And this is not the first time we've seen this. Matter of fact, I'll tell you a quick story. Last time we saw this whole hubbubaloo in Florida, in this area with the recounts due to the hanging chads, was the presidential election back in the 2000s there. And I remember exactly where I was because I was supposed to be on halftime report or lunch or something on CNBC with Bill Griffith. And I was, you know, you go in the green room, you wait, you go to makeup, and they put on some makeup on you. And then I'm sitting in the chair, and I'm about to be interviewed at the time. And all of a sudden you hear over the, you know, in your earpiece, we're on hold for this segment just for a moment because we may have some breaking news on the presidential election on who's going to win. Okay. I'm thinking, interesting. Okay. So we wait a few minutes and all that. And then Bill Griffith says to me, you know, we warm up, we talk a little bit, getting ready to talk about things and go over the topics that he wanted to talk about and interview me. And there I am sitting already. Oh, with my makeup, I'm looking good. I'm feeling good. And the next thing I know, They said, all right, we are cutting this segment, going right to Washington. And that was that. I got out of the chair, had to now walk around Manhattan to my next place. I think it was going to Bloomberg TV at the time. And still had the makeup on, so I guess it was good. But anyway, that was one of my experiences on CNBC. I had a few others. I was on a couple different shows there. That was fun back then. I really don't like doing the TV these days. It's just too much of an effort to get up there and, you know, for a 30-second interview that it could or could not be possibly changed at any given time. And it's much better, in my opinion, to talk. And the medium of podcasting really has taken on a whole new and just a much more, I think, integral part of the universe of finance and, well, all sorts of areas. But in the area of finance, it's just so much better because you can spend a lot more time delving into the discussions that you want to get into and having some great guests as well. And as a matter of fact, speaking of guests, we had some really nice commentary on last week's guest. We had Danielle DiMartino Booth on, and we talked about the Fed and some of the things that she's projecting into the future in terms of the economy and interest rates. If you hadn't had the opportunity to do so, you definitely need to listen to her because she is a smart one. Brings us some really great information on a regular basis that really doesn't hold back and doesn't hedge and doesn't have an agenda that she's trying to put forth. So I think that if you have the chance to listen to her and also read her works, I think it would be in your interest to do so. Well, let's talk about what's going on with the markets a little bit. We did see a decent week for most major indices. We saw the S&P 500 up about 2.1% for the week. Yeah, we had a little bit of sell-off at the end of the week after the Fed came out with their comments and some of the election concerns that we had. And of course, with the latest reading on wholesale inflation vis-a-vis the PPI, Producer Price Index. And while the Fed did have a relatively, I would say, upbeat commentary, they had a really good look at the markets and the economy and said that, you know, things are going pretty well. As a matter of fact, we're seeing strong growth, and that's pretty good. A lot of people thought, well, on one hand, that's really good to hear that we're continuing to see this. There's no concern about the Fed, but they don't really ever have much of a concern. Even in times of the greatest strife for markets, the economy, they're finding good things to say like, well, we have green shoots, or we're starting to see things that are better. They really never will come out and overtly say, hey, you know what, guys? Hey, is this mic on? Listen up. Things are terrible. I mean, hey, listen, I'm going to tell you guys, you know what, I can introduce lower rates and do things like quantitative easing, but man, things are gosh darn awful. They don't ever do that. They tell you things on more of the positive side. But what you have to do is read between the lines and understand what they're doing. And they've talked about very clearly, without even having to read between the lines, that, well, they're going to be increasing interest rates, at least in December. We see that as almost a 100% probability at this point. And they're talking about 2 to 3, at least into 2019, to get to more of a normalized position. Now, of course, you're going to have to back that off and it will all be dependent on economic data and what's going on with the economy and things of that nature. But you throw that into the idea that their mandate is all about employment and inflation, and both are moving well above, or at least close to, the employment issue is far gone already. It's well below their mandate number. So that's one thing that you have to remember. But inflation has been kind of creeping around both sides of that 2% level, and something that they're not that concerned about. As a matter of fact, they talked about letting it overheat. It's okay. Let the economy run a little bit longer, a little bit hotter. That's okay. But yet, when we see that they have in their commentary about how strong the economy is, you have to realize that they are really probably talking about much greater potential for rate hikes than not moving forward. Again, with the caveat that it is possible that things change. And then all of a sudden, something's going to happen in 3 months or 6 months from now that may have them take their foot off the pedal for at least a period of time. And you have to realize, I think it's important to understand that they have to raise rates. Because if we get into an economic downturn, whether it's because of the Fed or not, whether it's because of outside forces or not, whether it's because the tariffs are really starting to bring up pricing and there's issues related to global trade, or whether it's because of sentiment that drops, or maybe the housing market that starts to roll over, whatever it may be. And again, even if it is their fault, it doesn't matter. Because most of the time, the Fed is the reason why we do see economic slowdowns and economic booms. I mean, they have the ability to increase and decrease liquidity and rates. That's what they do. So even if they are the cause of it, they will have to have some ability to reduce rates, to try their best to bring back some growth. If we're starting out at zero, the zero line, there's not much they could do. They need ammunition. They're restocking. It may seem kind of weird to people. They say, wait. They're raising rates in order to lower them in the future? Yeah, that's kind of what they're doing. They're bringing rates higher so that they can normalize and hopefully say, you know what? If the market doesn't like it for a little while, well, it's okay. We have some room to run. We have a little cushion there. But with all the things that we see out there, it's more important that we have ammunition ready that we can actually reduce rates in a meaningful way, maybe over time or maybe very quickly, in order to make sure the economy doesn't fall into a total tailspin, into a recession that's prolonged and very, very problematic. Now, we also had the midterm elections last week. And like I said, when I first started, we're beyond the elections. No, we're not. We're seeing recounts in several different areas. Not much change in the total outcome, even if we see 100% turnaround in any of these areas that are seeing the recounts, but still enough to be a little bit of thorn in the side of some of this. Again, I don't think it's going to have much impact on the markets, except for the fact that there's a question that has to be raised about the potential for bad reporting, bad counting, and you know their confidence gets broken. And once confidence gets broken, there are ramifications for that. So whether it's locally based in Broward County, Florida, or somewhere in Arizona, or any other area around the United States, that's a problem because you have to wonder the sanctity of the election, of the quality of the count, and the information, and then the final numbers that are counted, and all those things are confidence builders or breakers, at least to in a small sense. But many were, I think, looking at the midterms as, oh my gosh, you know, if the Democrats get in, they're going to start looking at possible impeachment hearings, and there'll be this gridlock that will happen, and oh my God. And so what I think happened before the midterms, with the idea that it was possible this blue wave that we saw all over the news was going to be possibly causing problems in the Senate and in the House, that a lot of players got, they hedged out, they sold off, they got their positions a little bit more squared up to protect themselves against what if. That didn't happen. So while we talked about that, if the Democrats took over both the House and the Senate, some people were saying there could be a 10 or 15% drop in the markets, or if the Dems come in, there's going to be a 3% fall off just if they take over the House. Or if the Republicans stay in and it's business as usual, well, the markets can continue doing what they do, which has been consolidating in a bit of a downtrend recently. But I think that there was a significant amount of offsided positioning going into the election, and that's why, even though we saw the Democrats take the House and there was a significant amount of blue that came over into that area, into the House, but again, that's just the House, that markets reacted very positively on the results. And the reason was that people said, well, all right, at least there's some gridlock here. It's not both House and the Senate. You know, gridlock's usually good. There may be some problems that are raised already. The Democrats are talking about subpoenaing President Trump for his tax returns and talking about impeachment hearings and all this other stuff. But at the same time, it's still business as usual. It may not be as easy. There may be some blocks on some fiscal expansion. I think that's what hurt things. But we did see that at the end of the week, the results came in. People relaxed, took a bit of a breather, took a breath, exhaled, said, you know what? Okay, nothing crazy really happened here that wasn't unexpected. Because this is really what was expected, if you think about it. Dow Jones Industrial Average, NASDAQ, also finished higher for the week, adding about 2.8% for the Dow, 0.7% for the NASDAQ. The Russell Small Cap was the outlier with only a 0.1% gain. And you have to wonder why that is. Does it have something to do with the Fed? Does it have something to do with the elections or something else entirely? But I was thinking about this, and you have to realize that I think that maybe many of the smaller companies that are domestically, you know, related and really have most of their revenues coming in from domestic style of spending were concerned because what if there is this gridlock? What if this infrastructure bill that was planned isn't going to go through? What if, you know, continue on the discussions of all the things that were an area that was really beneficial for the small cap companies. And look at the fact that the banks also are a big part, especially the smaller regional banks, are a big part of the Russell 2000. So you have to wonder that with an increase in interest rates, the possibility of gridlock, less fiscal stimulus, that maybe some of these smaller banks and also, who knows, maybe a slowdown in the deregulation process, that maybe some of these small caps were hit by that and are going to continue to have a struggle now that all of a sudden we have a split Congress. I mean, the bigger banks and the major financials were not much better. If you look at their charts for this year, they're not pretty at all. They look pretty awful. Pretty awful. That's the only pretty they have is pretty awful. I mean, they're down for the year. So Goldman Sachs dropped about 4% on Friday, something like that. But if you look across the board, you look at Bank of America, Citi, you look at Wells Fargo, you look at Morgan Stanley. Yeah, they had some decent pops after the earnings that they always seem to have, but they've been rolling off. Every single rally seems to be reason to sell when it comes to these banks. So there's something else going on beneath the surface here, and you have to wonder if it's this combination of interest rates rising as well as the fact of weakness overseas. Because our banks here obviously do a lot of business overseas. And the trouble that we're seeing in Italy, the trouble we're seeing in a variety of areas in Latin America, some of that has to be a negative impact to these banks. And one of the things we're also seeing in these markets over the last few weeks is this incredible movement and almost an exacerbation of every side of the equation. So when you see it move up, it moves up really hard. When it moves down really hard. These are not moves that you see usually in a solid bull market. A market that is low when it comes to the volatility. A market that has a characteristic that is traditionally aligned with more of a traditional uptrend. Usually don't see these kind of moves on a regular basis. Every once in a while, you see something. But you won't see these 200, 300, 400 point swings in the Dow and 2% on the S&P up or down. And you just don't see that. You usually see that in a market that's in a downtrend, in a correction style market, in a market that is plagued by a lot of concerns, whereas when it moves up, people will take it up for a little while. The bears, the sellers will hold off, and then they'll attack again and take it lower. And we're moving into these oversold and overbought levels in the territory of when you measure these much more quickly now than we've seen in a long time. Matter of fact, over the last month or so, we've seen these violent moves that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks that, you know, you're going to see these violent rallies and these violent drops. And that's exactly what's going on right now because we are in a market that is, we'll call it correcting. A market that there are sellers that are not just laying off after a day or so. They're coming back and hitting again. And if you think about what's happened over the last number of years, where you have all these people that are buying the dips and they're leveraging up and they're buying again and they're holding on, not selling. They're thinking, you know what? I'm not selling anything because each time I've done so years ago, it just went right back up again. So I'm going to buy in even more. I'm going to average down. And the dip comes and they buy again. And what happens is that now all of a sudden you have a fully invested portfolio by institutions, individuals, hedge funds, etc. And when the dips come, they don't sell. They buy more until all of a sudden you get now the weak hands that get in there that say, wait. I have a lot of cash in my portfolio. I've seen these dips before. I'm buying in. Now what happens is when you get into a truly correcting market, a market that could be moving into bear market territory, you know, markets that are going to drop over time. Now you have to liquidate all of the leveraged funds that were out there, all the leverage accounts. Everybody's got to liquidate. They don't want to get margin calls. They got to start liquidating. Once that happens, they don't necessarily feel like they want to buy back in again. They want to wait and see what happens here. They don't want to re-leverage up. They don't want to get themselves into a position that can be really difficult on their portfolios and on their net worth. Meanwhile, the weak hands are getting in there and they'll sell off at any sign of trouble, which will then take you down to the next leg. And all of a sudden you have many of the players that are out there saying, you know what, maybe there's something to this. And what we need to do is lighten up. So now you're out of your leveraging, your weak hands start selling, and you have the core holders that are starting to get nervous. And the core holders start selling. And that's why each time you see this market move up lately, you're seeing a very quick movement to chop that off and to sell. So we have a contradiction between the buyers and the sellers. We have those that are possibly buyers that are starting to get a little bit of a break in their confidence. Sentiment has definitely shifted dramatically over the last month or so. Now, whether or not it's from a lot of things that we've talked about at nauseam here, right? We talked about all of this. We've talked about, you know, first quarter of 2019 possibly having some very significant downside risk. If all of the areas that I've been talking about line up well with the tariffs, with the Fed, with much more difficult earnings comparisons from a year ago, all these things are going to come into play and converge approximately in the first quarter of 2019. And you have to wonder if somebody's getting smart to this. If the players that have significant amounts of money or have been overallocated to equities are starting to say, you know, maybe we should start taking a little bit off just in case. And when they see the markets move up higher, they say, you know what? We're going to take a little bit off from there. And that's why we're seeing these violent moves. Because nobody is really feeling very good about their positioning right now. So we also have the other thing that's going on is we have serious headline risk. Let's face it. The headline risk has been monumental. And we're seeing institutions and individuals position themselves on one side or the other ahead of any of this, whether it's the Fed, whether it's more tariff talk, whether it's things like the Attorney General being removed from office, or, you know, we haven't heard anything about North Korea forever, but maybe China saying, hey, we're not going to play. Apple's possible slowdown. We had the elections into it. So people are possibly getting offsided and hedging out and then moving back in and moving out on each of these. And the machines, of course, and the algos are having a field day. So, I mean, there's all this headline risk on top of many of the areas that we've talked about in terms of the headwinds. And then the other thing that was really interesting, and talk about headwinds here or headlines, is that there's been a concern that inflation is picking up. And all of the reasons that we saw over the last several months, where we saw a bit of a tick up in wage growth, and the employment rate keeps on going down, more jobs have been added, input pricing is going up due to tariffs. And well, what we did see finally was a pretty significant number with the wholesale inflation number on Friday. Pretty interesting what we saw here. Came in, I would say, pretty hot at 0.6% increase on a month-over-month basis versus the 2.2% that was expected. Core PPI, the producer price index, was at 0.5%. So the headline was at 0.6%, core was at 0.5%, and both were expected to be at about 0.2%. Now, there's something to take note of. That's something to wake up to and say, oh, hey, whoa, what is going on here? So what I did was I kind of looked at what were the reasons for this? What's behind the numbers? What are we finding that's causing this? One of the things was that gasoline prices jumped dramatically. That was a big part of some of this. And that could be transient. It could be a temporary aberration that we're seeing post-summer, and when the prices of oil was a bit higher and gas prices kind of went up a little bit, you see them starting to come down again, because we did see oil now enter a bear market, down 20% from its high. I think it had one of the longest losing streaks on a daily basis in like 35 years. Something ridiculous. There was some crazy number I saw last week about crude oil's losing streak. But I also looked at, if you haven't done so, if you haven't checked out briefing.com, this is a quick aside here. Briefing.com has just a great service for looking at what's going on an economic basis, stock by stock basis, earnings call analysis and guidance. And just there's so much information. If you want a coach or an assistant or a trading partner, briefing.com has some great solutions. I'm not paid by them. I'm not getting paid by them. But I do use their service. Now, let me tell you what they wrote. They said the index for final demand services increased 0.7%. And that was the largest increase since January 2016 and accounted for over 60% of the rise in final demand prices. So services were a big part of all this. The index for final demand of goods increased 0.6%. And most of that gain stemmed from a 2.7% increase in the index for final demand energy, which was led by a 7.6% jump in the gasoline index. The index for processed goods for intermediate demand increased 0.8%, and the index for unprocessed goods for intermediate demand was up 3.6%, which is the largest rise since the beginning of this year. Beginning of 2017, sorry, January 2017. So there are some areas in this that you could say, well, let's wait and see what happens moving forward, because some of this jumped pretty significantly, and it usually doesn't happen on a month-by-month basis. Now, if we saw 2 or 3 months like this put together, now then you have to worry, and you have to then say, well, what's causing all this? How is that going to play out when it comes to the CPI, which we're going to see this week coming up? And then how does that then translate into margin pressure, which has been the complaint of companies in their recent conference calls post-earnings due to blaming it on the tariffs? A lot of blame is being laid on the tariffs for margin pressure and for the fact that they are getting higher input prices. And the question is going to be, how long can they hold out and not pass it on to the consumer? When they do pass it on to the consumer, what is the consumer going to do with it? Are they going to take it and say, ah, that's fine, thank you? Or are they going to balk at the prices, and that's going to see a slowdown in overall sales, revenue decrease? And then now we're talking about a much bigger problem that then goes into, you know, the overall economy, where you see spending slows down dramatically because people just don't, are not having the ability to pay for certain items, and that just feeds upon itself. And this is why the Fed wants to keep inflation at bay, but hasn't seen too much of it to be a problem. Deflation and hyperinflation are problematic. Inflation itself, not so much. Baseline inflation at 2% a year, everybody could live with, as long as that is in fact keeping pace at the same level as we're seeing wage growth and overall wealth effect, etc. Once we get into an inflationary environment that's too fast, that causes a massive slowdown in the economy. That is exacerbated by the fact that the Fed, well, it could be, let's put it this way, it can cause a massive slowdown in the economy as the Fed then goes ahead and continues to raise interest rates to tamp down that inflation. So inflation itself, again, not too bad if this baseline inflation, but when you get some, you know, hyperinflation, which everybody's feared, by the way, for the last 10 years happening, which never appeared due to a lot of different reasons. Productivity gains in terms of technology, offshoring of manufacturing, you know, the dollar and currency valuation differentials between here and there, wherever there is around the world. So we got to keep an eye on this, but I think markets are going to be investors are going to have their antennas up high looking at next week's numbers when it comes to inflation and the inflation numbers moving forward, because everybody is starting to wonder how we're not getting more inflation when we see such great job numbers and such a strong economy, combined with the fact that we know that prices are higher. There's no mystery here anymore. The artificial increase in prices due to tariffs has to flow through. I have a friend that I was out to dinner with last week, and he's a manufacturer. He basically manufactures a lot of his goods in China. And historically, any taxes that were imposed or anything that had to be paid for on the importation of his products, let's call them widgets, into the United States would be actually taxed at the ports. When they arrived in, his agent and customs agents would put a tax on it, and he'd get the goods, and then he would sell them to the manufacturers. From that point, they would assemble, put them together, and then send it to the retailers and get them out there. Well, he told me that recently there was a change to all this with all these tariffs. No longer in his situation, for whatever reason, I don't know if this is his particular industry or what's going on at his level of importation that's going on, or the goods, the particular goods that he has, which a lot of metals, we'll call it, steels, aluminums, etc. It used to be, like I said, he would get the tax at the port and they would pay it and they would come in. Now what's happening is they are directly taking it from his bank account. His corporate bank account, that is, company's bank account. So let's say that goods come in, and whatever the amount of goods that come in, and let's just say there's $100,000 of excise taxes in the form of tariffs, et cetera, that have to be paid on these goods. The goods come in, they arrive in. Once they arrive in, his bank account automatically gets whacked for this amount of money that has to be paid. Let's call it the $100,000. So no longer does he have any time that he can work it out, that he sells the product off, he takes the final money in, the money's in his account, he sells it to the next level, pays his tariff, his tax, his excise. They take it out well before immediately. Now, what does he have to do with that? Well, he has to suck it up, first of all. But secondly, now, he may have a shortage of monies to buy goods again. He may be a little bit more, we'll say, deliberate in his purchases and slow down so that he could time things better in order to get payment from the next firm that owes him the money to put the money in the account. He may ask for money in advance from his clients and customers, because he, can you imagine if you kind of multiply that out, how much he's going to have to float for these taxes before he gets final payment? He's freaking out. How am I going to do this? So that's what's going on, at least in that circumstance. And it's a change in the business environment. You may wonder how that's going to hold up, and if this is a broad-based situation, if that's going to cause any more problems with the entire manufacturing chain of events that go on from start to finish, if there's any imported goods that go on. Now you may say, well, you know what? If he gets his goods in the United States, there are no tariffs. He won't have to do this. So he's being forced into buying goods rather than from China here. Well, yeah, okay. I'll go with that. But the fact is that just the cost of goods is so much cheaper and the demand for the goods only is a certain price here in the United States. And so he may have to look to find other ways of manufacturing this. No question about that. And in the end, that could be good for U.S. companies. So, you know, people that have this situation that's going on, manufacturers that have this may say, screw this, I'm not dealing with any of this, and decide very easily to change where they source their materials. And you may say that's good for the United States-based companies. It's possible, assuming that those materials can be sourced here. So I'll keep you updated on that as we move along. All right, let's talk a little about technicals, market structure, because a lot of interesting things happened during the week. And there is this, I think, that a lot of technical moves going on right now when it comes to the markets. A lot of reasons that things are buying, people are buying and selling, that is due to some of the headlines we talked about. But if you look at the technicals, I think there's a lot of technical components that are going into how things are playing out right now. And let's stay very simple for a second here. Let's start with the very simple moving averages, a discussion of the S&P 500, currently below its declining 50-day moving average. So if you look at a chart and you chart the S&P 500, maybe the SPY index, SPY ETF, which is the index equivalent ETF, for the S&P 500, and you chart that on a plain daily chart, and you just look at it, and then you overlay a 50-day moving average, which is a simple version of a moving average, which looks at the past 50 days and adjusts, and it says moving because every 50 days, you know, you look back, and then you take those numbers, you move it forward, calculate the 50 days, move it forward. So if you look at that line, which is now declining, so that means that prices over the last 50 days have been going lower, which makes sense. Right now, it is below the 50-day moving average. That's something to take note of. Now, in terms of a longer-term average, we look at the 200-day moving average. Now, different people look at different averages. You have the 100-day, 150-day, the 20-day, 10-day. We're just talking about the 50 and the 200 because these are two key averages that are looked at very closely by institutions. And you want to follow where the big money is, so let's follow where the institutions are looking at as well. So the S&P 500 bounced off the 200-day moving average on Friday and managed to close above. That's good. Now we get a little bit more technical. We look at something called the 50-day exponential moving average. This weights the more recent price closes at a higher level, so it puts a greater weight on the more recent price closes called the exponential moving average. I'm trying to keep this simple. But we did see the S&P shoot above it on Wednesday, but came down and closed below it on Friday. Now, it tested the upper limits, but it couldn't close above it. So now what we say is support has turned into resistance. So the 50-day moving average is now a resistance point for the S&P 500 in the form of SPY. It's very similar when it comes to the NASDAQ 100, the Qs. So we're, again, seeing that when we look at various indicators, we are seeing a general trend lower, holding support of the longer-term trend line, but below the shorter-term trend line. Now let's get a little bit more fancy. Let's get just a little bit more. Let's look at the McClellan indicator. Different names of this, but the McClellan indicator that I look at is an oscillator. Now, we saw it shoot up to levels not seen in years, above 200 and change, just last week or so, after we saw that from 2 weeks ago to now, because we saw that incredible rally off of a low point. And it was a sign of a, what's called a simple formation that was possibly something that we should probably pay attention to. It's often a contrarian indicator. So a very, very high level of a McClellan reading that is in a simple, so it's not, it hasn't stayed above there for long. It's just kind of shot up from below. So it was down low, it shot up, and just all of a sudden it went to a crazy level way high in the plus 200 range. That's a sign of an overbought situation that may just be a quick rally in a general downtrending market. So this is often a contrarian indicator. Now, the Spearman indicator, something you've heard me talk about a lot, especially when markets get a little wonky, I like to pull these out and look at where we are on some of this. The Spearman indicator is near the upper bounds recently and started to roll over towards the end of last week. Another contrarian indicator, especially when it starts rolling below the 90 level. Now, the Spearman did a really good job calling the low at around, right around October 30th, I believe it was. The KRI indicator, something that we've developed here, it kind of was a little bit early, called a bottom towards about the 12th to 15th, and then some divergent type of characteristics about mid-level in October. Same thing with McClellan, showed a bottom forming on about 10, 11, divergence higher reading on the 24th. So it was a little bit early on that as well. But I think when we look at now all of these together, we're seeing that we're seeing a declining 50-day moving average and kind of bouncing off the 200, seeing some of these violent moves on the upside and downside, signs again of a downtrending market. We're looking at levels of the Spearman and the McClellan that get really hot really fast and then start to roll over, signs of a quick overbought inside of a correcting market. None of these things look really good. Now, I'm still holding with the fact that there is the potential for there to be a bit of a rally into year end. We started to see that last 2 weeks. Last week was a good week, generally speaking. So I think we're going to see some volatility inside of this, but still the potential for a decent rally. And then again, towards the end of the year, into the beginning of next year, I'm going to start worrying if everything is looking as it looks today, then we got a problem. If nothing changes from where we are today, I still think we may have a bit of a problem in the first quarter of 2019 that will be based on a very serious economic slowdown that is going to start to show signs in that period and moving into the first half of the year, and the markets may not be happy about it. Let's just say that. A couple of things. A couple other things I want to mention here, and then we'll get to the listener questions. It's funny because I was looking at a stock, PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. Horrible wildfires in California, and the winds are picking up and people are dying and property is being just demolished. And it's horrible. It's terrible. But every time we see a fire in California, PGE, symbol PCE, gets hit. Because everybody believes, oh man, I bet you it was the electrical lines that sparked these fires. PG&E was down 17% on Friday to levels that we haven't seen since the last time we thought there was some problem with what they were doing. And there'd be some kind of wires that sparked the fire back in earlier this year. We had both February and June of 2018 lows that we're seeing again start to get towards. And it's funny because we had a question about PG&E in a listener question, which we'll get to. A couple more things here. We're making some changes to portfolio allocations. It's something probably that you should be looking at what your general portfolio is comprised of in terms of the allocation to various sectors, asset classes, both domestically and internationally. We're making some changes in the process of rebalancing portfolios for our clients. And that's in our global allocation portfolios, our core portfolios, and Investology. And I want to mention that, you know, we're looking to kind of decrease some areas, increase some other areas, and then do a rebalance also, because there's a change in the outlook that we're seeing. And I just told you all about that. But you need to go over and check this out, because what you could do is you could kind of run a scenario for yourself to see kind of where we're looking at how the risk should be laid out in terms of the global asset allocation and sector allocation over at Investology. Now, this is, if you haven't heard me talk about this before, you're new to the show, it's a $10,000 minimum investment. Very simple process. This was created for you upon the request of listeners. We took the best of robo-advising and traditional advisory, and we call it our advisor-crafted and technology-enhanced process. Kind of think of RoboCop, part human, part machine, versus all machine, which is what you have at a lot of those traditional robo-advisors. So kind of a whole different thing. We took the best of the front end and processes and then blended that into what we do and kind of came up with this hybrid, if you will. You can see how it works going over and checking it out, because what you could do is you can actually go through the questionnaire. You can come up with, okay, well, this is the risk that we look like makes sense for me. And then it creates a portfolio on the fly for you. And then, like I said, if you want to continue, want us to handle it for you, invest it for you, $10,000 minimum, all the information is there. You can check that all out at investology.com with an E, investology.com. So now it's time. We'll get to some of the listener questions that came in. I mentioned earlier, and I'll say it again, that from now to the end of the year, if you do want to get a copy of my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, you can send a listener question in via the website over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You just have to go to the Ask Andrew section, put in a question, we'll read them on the air, and randomly pick one question per week, one winner per week, and we'll send you a book. So there you go. So here's a couple of questions that came in. John Rogers asked me, hey, does the Spearman indicator work well for intraday Forex trading? We talked about the Spearman today a bit, but yes. So the Spearman, and the reason why is the Spearman indicator is basically a statistical analysis. It uses price and trend and turning points. Essentially, when you get to approximately plus 90, you start looking at that the trend is positive. When it starts to roll and change, the trend is changing. Some people look at plus 90, negative 90, or plus 80 and negative 80 for those overbought and oversold levels. I kind of go, you know, towards that as well, but the 90s, never get much higher than that. But when you get an extreme point, it could last for some time and the trend is positive on the upside of plus 90 or so. But then you start to roll over, you get a crossing of the moving average of the Spearman. Then you got to start wondering, what's going on there? Same thing on the bottom. When you get those crosses below negative 90 and then starts to move higher and a divergence, and then clearly when it gets above zero. So yeah, it can be used for Forex. It's all about pricing, so that works fine. It can work on any time frame too. So you got the Forex and the intraday time frame covered there. So John, thanks for that question. Rod Lars sends in a question. He says, hey Andrew, I've been listening to the Money Talk for better than 25 years when it was ended last month. So I was looking for a new source of financial information and brought me to your podcast, and happily so. Well, thanks. Welcome aboard, Rod. So he said he listened to episode number 586 when I described switching from fixed income investments to short duration as a way of avoiding interest rate risk. And he said, I did that myself a couple of years ago on the air suggestion of Bob Brinker, but also because of at the time investing interest rates had nowhere to go but up anyway. So now I find the fixed income portion of my portfolio invested in short-term bond mutual funds and money market funds. And so basically his question is this. Is there a rule of thumb, he asks, if that I could suggest to use to decide when to start moving from the short-term back to longer duration bond funds like the total market index fund? So talking about, he also talks about the Fed and talks about the relationship of the dropping NAV and all that. I think you have to look out long-term and look for where there's going to be either a plateauing, Rod, of the interest rates, where you can feel comfortable that you're not going to see a very significant rise in inflation and therefore Fed chasing that for some time, increasing interest rates over there. in order to avoid the problems associated with that in a longer term bond fund, which are very simply, which is a degradation of your principal. So I would look to where that inflection point is and when the Fed is going to stop raising rates, where they reach an equilibrium point to the kind of normalized rate. And that would probably be in, I would say, 2 or 3 more hikes from here. And then you can start tiptoeing back into a longer duration bond. And what that does for you, by the way, it also protects you and gives you a decent rate currently in the shorter term yields, in the shorter term maturity and shorter term duration. And then when the time is such, you go back into bonds that have a much higher yield. It's kind of like timing the housing market just right. You get out of a house at the peak, you rent for a while, you still live in there, paying a little bit of rent. Okay, fine. But then you move back in when housing prices drop again. You do that over again and over again. It's not that easy to do. Timing anything is not easy to do. So I don't think there's an absolute answer for this, but I think that if you hold on for more normalization, get in when rates are a bit higher, you'll be in much better shape. So thanks for that. Peter says, Peter Winter writes and he says, hey, Andrew, you mentioned you're going to South Africa. He said, best value for the money of any country I visited. He asked me about PG&E. He says, looks like it's on a steady climb again. What do you think of it these days? And he asked me this is about a week and a half ago, that I got this in. I think I mentioned that, Pete. I think you got an interesting entry point here at the bottom of the range where there's been support on a few other occasions in 2018. But at the same time, I think you can have a pretty wicked ride with this one, dependent on what happens with the whole issue of fires in California. And each time that there's going to be one, you don't know when it's happening. You don't know when it's going to occur unless you're, I don't know, plugged into the fire department or something. So you got to watch out for that because, like I said, you know, you can get whacked on this at any given time out there. We have a question from Dave Knowles. He says, what factors do you consider when determining an entry point for a stock that is higher, that is at the higher end of its price range and near its 52-week high? Thanks for the show. Keep up your great work. Dave, thanks for the great comment. And it's a great question because it's very difficult when you're working on a technical basis and a stock is above its all-time high to figure out, well, where's it going? Because all you have now is the support at the old all-time high level or other tops in the past, or possibly if you get fancy using you could use something like a Fibonacci extension, or you could possibly be looking at a continuation process by calculating possibly there's a flag, for example, the continuation of a flag, or even some triangle that you're going to use in drawing objects on the chart. But it's very difficult because once you get that extension, there's nowhere left to go. The shorts are probably out at that point. Now, when you get to a 52-week high, that's all dependent on, well, is it a 52-week high in a longer-term structure that has other highs that it can get to? Got to look at also what the market itself is doing, because 80% of a stock's move is also most of the time attributable to the directionality of the market. So a high correlation of what the market does and what the stock does. So an entry point is very difficult. Once you pass over a previous high, it's oftentimes when you'll see a quick boost of a stock price due to the fact that anybody that was possibly looking to keep a short position on will say, hey, that's my line in the sand, so they get out. Also, people would say, well, if it moves beyond this, it's been consolidating for a period of time, and it's finally, well, maybe it's going to break out, then they start getting into it as well. But once you start getting into an all-time high condition, very difficult to look at anything from there. Last question comes in from Peter Parsons, and he says, we know that tariffs are bad for international trade, but are they good for governments? Does the tax increase from the tax tariff exceed the tax decline from lower company profits, delivering an improvement in the overall budget position. I feel like I answered something like this recently. I think it was a similar question. I don't think it was the exact question, but it's a good question because one never knows. The question, though, is where is the money coming out of and going into? So now if that money that's being paid to the government is from the profits that would have been from the companies or from the consumer that has to pay up more, it's a tax. And a tax is a tax is a tax. Any way you want to look at this, it's taxing somebody, somewhere, somehow. So I don't care where the money goes into. If it's going into the government coffers to pay for all the tax reductions that they have and try to offset that. So you got the tax reductions, but then you have the increase and it negates it all. So I don't think we could try to figure out a way to twist around how tariffs are a good thing by trying to say, well, maybe they'll do some benefit over it. They're not good. End of sentence. Tariffs equal not good, period. So I think there's some reasonable way to look at this and trying to rationale out of, well, maybe they're not so bad, but I can't really find it. Because they always come around to the answer to the question, but then realize, well, then again, it's a tax. And higher taxes means lower profitability somewhere to someone somehow. So there you go. All right, we picked up, we'll leave this question until next week over here because there's a lot of questions this week. All right, we did pick a winner. Let's see, I marked it somewhere. Somebody we pulled blindly out. Okay, David Knowles. David Knowles wins the book this week. So, David, if you would send me your address, mailing address, we will send you a book, The Disciplined Investor. So thanks for that. Again, just write in your question, and you could be a lucky winner as well till the end of this year. With that, we're going to close this week's episode and look forward to next week and the weeks ahead. We have some cool guests coming up as always. Of course, do yourself a favor. Listen in to DH Unplugged, where myself and John C. Dvorak go at it every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. live with a listener chat room live. You can kind of chat with us back and forth on the listener chat room each and every week. You can listen live at 9 o'clock. And follow me on Twitter. You'll find out all the information on how to get there. Andrew Horowitz, one word on Twitter, and that will get you what you need to do. Thanks for joining me, and I am going to talk with you again next week. Thanks.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.